Good morning, Santa Barbara. This morning we're surfing the Middle East, promoting youth literacy, and eating some chocolates, or talking about some chocolates, on Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB 91.9 FM. Yes, it is. KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Colin Marshall. This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent, every Tuesday morning, 8 until 9. Right now, playing the first of many cuts we've got rounded up by the pop culture editor of the paper, Ali Cumingor. It's Foster the People and Houdini. They're playing Soho on Tuesday, March 8th. As I said, more coming, so if you like this music, stay tuned, because we've got tracks, we've got concert details, but most importantly, we have got stories from the indie, stories that'll be in the indie, stories that have been in the indie. We are giving you the extra coverage on them here on Poodle Radio. By the way, there's a cover story coming up about, well, it's Santa Barbara, so it's going to be about surfing, but it's about surfing in the Middle East, which adds a whole other dimension to it. And it's also about surfing in the Middle East and then putting out a sort of revolutionary type of ebook about it. So in the studio here, I've got Jesse Eisenstadt, and he's just getting his headphones on, but he has put out this ebook, Surfing the Middle East, excuse me. Jesse, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing quite well. Yourself?
I'm doing pretty good.
This is, it's no Middle East surf trip right now, but it's kind of exciting, right?
It's pretty exciting. Yeah.
Okay, then. So let's get the details out, because, of course, the cover story is not going to be out until Thursday. But you have an ebook, Surfing the Middle East, part one of three, telling about a journey where you did that very thing. But let's take it back to the beginnings of that journey. You graduate from college. What awaits you after the collegiate experience? What does the world offer you right then?
Well, I'd just first say sheer terror. Because most people, you know, they go to college, they're in the liberal arts track, and they don't necessarily think about it. They don't have, like, a plan of action afterwards. And when I graduated, which was in May 2009, everyone in my class was graduating into the worst job economy since the Great Depression. So there's kind of like this yuck that hangs over everyone, because nobody knows, you know, what in God's name they're going to do with their lives.
Right.
And it's scary. It really is. You know, a lot of people take out college loans, et cetera, et cetera. So my solution, I went to the University of San Diego, and was to go to a bullfight and skip my college graduation just to kind of write off the whole experience. And that was kind of the beginning of surfing the Middle East.
You mentioned in the article, you've got two passions here, surfing and understanding the Middle East. Surfing, now were you Santa Barbara born and raised?
Indeed, sir, indeed.
So that explains the surfing, but the understanding the Middle East, now that's a much less common passion around these parts. So what got you into the Middle East?
study abroad. I would say study abroad is the most underrated part of any college education because it's not like, I'm telling you what to do because I'm a scholar and this is a classroom. It's like puts you out into the world and you can acquire operational experience of how the world actually works, which is an incredible thing because once you graduate from college, you kind of go back into the world and into things that, you know, situations where you have to react. And I did a study abroad to Greece and Turkey in 2007, and then through City College, Santa Barbara City College, and then ended up traveling all over the Middle East. I volunteered at a Palestinian refugee camp in the West Bank city of Nablus, and it all just kind of stemmed from there. It kind of pinched an interest gland, as they say.
So you had to have a little bit of interest in the Middle East then, if you're going to think about spending so much time there, even on a study abroad. I mean, was this an area where it's like, this might be an important part of the world, I should get over there and maybe get a grasp on it?
It's very, very simple. You look at the globe and you say, you know what, I am 25 years old right now. The Middle East is the story of my generation. Period. Mm. I mean, like, there is no other ifs, ands, or buts. I mean, it is the action area on the globe. That is the one place everyone wants to know something about. I mean, it all kind of comes back there.
Now, you say to yourself you want to do some surfing in the Middle East. How much harder is that done than said?
this is kind of maybe the fatal flaw in conceptualizing some kind of surf thing, because in California we have these wonderful highways. You can drive from Santa Barbara to Oxnard in however many minutes. That same distance is the distance from a place I surfed in, the northern Israeli city of Haifa, to this place in southern Lebanon called Jia. And it's about the same distance, but because the border is closed between Israel and Lebanon, you got to go back through the West Bank, you go into Jordan, you fly over Syria, land into Lebanon, you change passports because there's a visa problem with the Israeli stamp on, you know, your passport. And it's just this whole thing. And that very hassle is surfing the Middle East. So it's an opportunity for me to do what I love to do here in Santa Barbara, but then kind of apply that as a journalist in the Middle East. And it's kind of like this adventure. So, you know, you can get so close to something, yet you're so far away. And because you're so far away, that allows you to dive into this story and this narrative of seeing the Middle East through like a very practical, on-the-ground experience.
So you can surf on both ends of your trip at the beginning and the end, but the rest of it, you have to go inland through a sort of gauntlet of administrative and territorial problems.
Oh, yeah. And it's just endless because I just remember one day waking up in Bethlehem, and then, you know, I was like, okay, I need to be in Beirut by dusk. It's like, all right, Bethlehem, back in Jerusalem, which is Israel, over to the West Bank, into Jordan. Let's fly over to Syria. Now we're landing in Beirut. It's like, was I just in four countries or five or three? Is the West Bank a country? Like, like endless like that. Literally endless.
What is the surfing community like in these places, in these countries? I mean, what surfing community did you find? Was there a larger sort of nation, quote unquote, of surfers that didn't really go by political boundaries? Or did you find pockets of surfers in each place you went that was anywhere near a coast?
Well, surfing is kind of like the international middle finger to everything. You know, I mean, it's like a way of expressing what it is. It's like, hey, man, this is just what I'm doing. Yet on the flip side, you know, that terrorist organization in southern Lebanon, Hezbollah, has about 50,000 Katyusha ex-Soviet rockets in their arsenal, and they're pointed right here. So, like, if you see one, maybe you should duck dive or something.
Right.
You know, so in Israel, I would say there's probably an estimated 10 to 15,000 Israeli servers. In Lebanon, there's significantly less. And these two communities, even though the Israeli one is significantly smaller, you know, they're on Google Maps, right? So they're scouring each other's coastlines, and there's kind of this constant, like, crowding around the computer, like, dude, look at this reef! And it's like, yeah, you can't go there because this is the Middle East, man. This is, like, a divided region. Like, you're Israeli. You cannot wander into Hezbollah-controlled southern Lebanon these days, man, unless, you know, it's the 2006 war or something.
You have this moment in the article that'll come out as the cover story on Thursday.
There's a cover story?
that you get pointed, this gets pointed out to you, the remains of a sign that got destroyed by a Hezbollah rocket. One of those moments where I'm sure you thought to yourself, oh yeah, it's the Middle East. What else made you think, oh yeah, this is not just surfing somewhere, this is surfing in the Middle East?
Ah, yes. There are moments of crossing the Rubicon. I am not in Kansas anymore. Alice going down the rabbit hole. Use whatever you like. But these moments literally, to me as a journalist, just struck bells going off. It's like, oh yeah, okay, here we go. We're driving back from a surf session at Carmel Beach in northern Israel with my friend, who's like this Israeli guy, the most like carefree like dude you could meet. And, you know, all of a sudden he just like wheels his four-cylinder jalopy off the side of the road and he like ascends this knoll. And I'm thinking, like, whoa. And we get up there and, you know, there's this whole sign blown away and this like little crater and everything. And I write about it in the iPad book. It's called The Knoll of the Rocket. And it's moments like that when you don't quite get it. And it's the very contrast of you're surfing, so you're not thinking about where you are sometimes. And it's that contrast that kind of is the formula I use throughout Surf in the Middle East. It's like on one hand it's like this, yet on the other hand it's like this. But these realities exist in different parts of our consciousness here, but over there, that is the consciousness. So it's a total experience. I highly recommend it.
By the way, you're tuned in to Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB 91.9 FM. I am talking to Jesse Eisenstadt, who's got a cover story in the Independent coming up, who's got an iPad book called Surfing the Middle East, telling his tale of doing exactly that. Now, we want to mention all the features of this book, but first, when did it occur to you that you had not necessarily this full-featured iPad book on your hands with a story, but some sort of project at all that you might make and share with the world?
There's actually been some debate about that. And when I go back and kind of review various things that I've written, it's kind of gray. You say, well, was it in Bethlehem that I knew I wanted to write a book? I knew I wanted to write a magazine article when I went, because, you know, the whole reason I went to the Middle East is because I couldn't find a job out of college. And I had some journalist connections over there. I brought a surfboard, and then I realized that this magazine article I wanted to write, which eventually got published in the Surfer's Journal, would actually work as a book. And then this whole iPad thing came along later. So, I mean, it's kind of an incremental part of the project, or parts of the project. It wasn't like this whole idea was hatched out at the Tijuana bullfight, you know.
So when the iPad came along, what features of it made you think, you know, I gotta maybe make this surfing story for this specific platform?
The only way I think I could respond to that is in an interview, somebody asked Marlon Brando, you know, hey Marlon, like, how'd you get into acting? And then Brando says, well, it was the only thing I could do until I figured out what I was going to do with my life.
Yes.
And I kind of feel that way about this. Like, I'm just not good at anything else, you know? And then for some reason, this iPad thing just clicked. I got hooked up with the right people. Obviously, the iPad is a new tablet, or it's a new kind of medium. They sold 15 million of them already, and then iPad 2s are coming out. So it's a new market. So the whole thing was just kind of a slow curveball that started to break.
Last week you showed me some of the features of this book, and it's got pages you can turn like a book, and it's got text like a book, but it's also got lots of images, it's got video embedded, it's got sound, it's got sections of you reading out loud, it's got maps. What else does this book have in it that you can't get in a paper book?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because a lot of people say, well, what about the Kindle thing, or what about, you know, ebook this or that? Well, this is an entirely new generation of ebooks, and by that I mean there is a media component that's kind of like a vicarious come-along kind of experience that is really just not there in the traditional paperback publishing world. And the idea is that you can come along and surf the Middle East as I did, and all the media and like pictures and slideshows and maps and original things. Like I scan a lot of my original papers, or my Foreign Service exam, which I flunked, is the first build out in the preface. And I failed my English expression, by the way, which I thought was an excellent thing to include in a book.
It's an ideal irony, yeah.
Yeah, so I would classify the whole thing as an experience, and the idea is that you can really follow that experience with this new interactive platform.
We mentioned when you were showing me this before that it's a little like when we were both kids, there was a big wave of multimedia CD-ROMs, and they were talking about books on CD-ROM, and now you can get videos, you can get images, you can get all kinds of things built in. You just get your books on CD-ROM, now pop them into your computer, and you get the complete multimedia experience. And I was thinking this is like that done correctly. You know, you said you had some experience with those older CD-ROMs. I mean, how does this improve on that?
Oh, man. I am dyslexic. I had a very hard time reading growing up. And you kind of, when you have that, I couldn't read till the fourth grade. I mean, just in all honesty, learning disabilities, I guess. But it's a learning difference, because it pushed me into exploring other mediums. And I really got into those CD-ROM books, even though they never really went anywhere. I think that it kind of planted a seed that, you know, not everyone reads left to right. And this platform on the iPad now, in Surfing the Middle East, allows you to kind of browse it in a non-linear way. But I also want to stress that it really is also designed to be linear. So you hold the iPad vertically, and it's in reader mode, and it's literally just text on the page with a kind of cool background, but it's not distracting. You can just crank through the text like a literary book. And then you flip the thing sideways. Oh boy, you're coming along, man. You're on the road. You're like, you know, riding donkey carts through South Lebanon with me. You know what I'm saying?
How far does this first volume take you in your journey? How far do we follow you in part one of three?
Well, that seems to be the question. The answer, I guess, is that it mostly takes place at the beginning of the journey. So the whole thing is broken down into thirds. So Surfing the Middle East, it's like Maui with rockets, which was a total gamble on the byline, because I don't know. I mean, you just put yourself, you do things and you don't know if it's any good. And then all of a sudden everyone starts laughing. Like, okay, I guess that's good. But anyway, the name of the first book, It's Like Maui with Rockets, is Haifa, which is in northern Israel. And then there's some flashback to that 2007 northern West Bank refugee camp experience. And that's kind of, I guess, what we call it, the production studio that made this, the kind of, quote, crazy Middle East section. That was, you know, June 2007, when Hamas and Fatah were vying for Palestinian territories. And there's kind of that crazy Middle East flashback experience.
Now, when you're writing a book like this, you have to, it seems like you have to please two different groups here. You've got to show you know about surfing, please the surfers. You've got to show you know about the Middle East as well, or at least that you understand the degree of complexity in the Middle East. I mean, what was the challenge of getting both those things across?
Yeah. Well, see, not to me. because that's kind of who I am. You know, I enjoy surfing, and that's what I look at. And I'm a journalist, so I'm always checking news wires and articles and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, coming out of the Middle East. Right. So to me, it was really the only natural thing to do. But then I realized that I'm kind of weird, and most people don't see the lens of reality through surfing and the Middle East. And then it became like a thing, like, wow, the juxtaposition here is just great. You know, it contrasts this reality. And I guess for me, it kind of fit, even though there are times of, you know, big adjustment. But there is that duality, and pleasing these kind of two crowds is something you always have to be conscious of. Are there enough surfing pictures? Yes, there are.
You can confidently say that. Now, as well, I mean, getting the audience to see the world through this lens of surfing in the Middle East, I mean, what are the challenges of making that accessible to everyone, even people who haven't gone to the Middle East or surfed? You know, how do you make that something that they can get into?
Well, I'd like to publicly thank my grandmother, Lois Hansen. She is from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I often thought of her while writing it, the surfing sections at least, thinking, okay, can someone who's never, you know, is from the middle of the country, has never stood up on a surfboard, never even like attempted to go surfing, will she be able to understand this? And that was kind of, you know, I just, you know, God bless her, but I just kept thinking of her the whole time. And that was kind of how I wrote it, is I really tried to build on the lowest levels of, you know, surfing knowledge, and then you kind of build up, and you really have to be conscious of slang. Surfing, well, I guess the Middle East and Middle East journalism too, but they're cultures of slang, so you kind of have to introduce it in a way.
Now, you get this all across, you build a way in to surfing and to the Middle East, and you have this iPad book, and it's been released. What sense do you have about how people are engaging with it? You know, are they taking it as a travelogue, or are they really trying to get in there as an experience that they can experience with you as they read about you? I mean, how are people reading this thing? You know, what feedback do you get about it?
Well, yeah, that's really funny. And just to be completely honest, just to be raw and honest in the most, you know, big way possible, I don't know. This product has just come out. We just got approved by Apple a number of days ago, and it's on the App Store. It's resting in its place. So people are overwhelmed, I think, by the new platform. I think a lot of people think it's cool. The most common question I get is, well, I don't have an iPad. Can I still read it? And I said, yes, after you buy your iPad. I wrote it, and I was conscious about doing it for this 15 million people who have iPads as of right now. Tablets continue to grow. The tablet market is probably going to be the hottest tech thing in 2011, as it was in 2010. But I think in 2011, and I'm sure this is question the next one or whatever, but I think 2011 is going to be the year that we see indie authors go mainstream. So like people like me can't necessarily knock on the door on some Manhattan publisher and just be like, hey man, like I got this like idea, like you interested? They're like, no, we're not interested. We're publishing Snooki's memoirs from Jersey Shore. And you're like, well, what about the literary thing? To hell with the literary thing.
We've got our hands full. We have Snooki.
So, I couldn't have said it better. But what I'm also saying is that these tablets provide a place for people to go. So you can publish your stuff for relatively low cost. And if you have what it takes, and I'm not saying, you know, anything about anything on that, but if you have what it takes, you can go mainstream in this new world of tech.
I take it you want to read more, or you want to write more of these kinds of ebooks, these kind of iPad books. Do you want to read more of them? Are you hoping your favorite authors all get on board with this iPad plan and make the kind of books that you're making with Surfing the Middle East?
Well, it's extremely cool in the sense that you get to use your skills as a writer. You get to use your skills as a producer, film editor. I'm sifting through old PDF not old, but, you know, PDF, like, articles from scholarly foundations and stuff that we use, that I used in college, and just all these things that are the media of surfing the Middle East. So it's a very, like, multi-brained thing, and I'm not sure, like, I don't think all authors necessarily should do this, at least in the way we did surfing the Middle East, but I think that it can really add a new dimension. Well, I think it does add a new dimension to travel books and how the future of that is going. And journalism, too, I should say, because all these artifacts that make the journalist's experience can just be conveyed in this larger sense now. It's just so much more in depth.
So we've got the cover story coming up on Thursday. We've got this app in the iTunes store. Where else can listeners go to learn more about surfing the Middle East and what you're doing with it?
They can go to my blog, which is www.bloggingthecaspa.com, and Caspa is C-A-S-B-A-H. There's also a Facebook page and Twitter and all these other new things of social media. And, you know, this is, like, the most interesting thing to me is that you don't just show up to Borders on a book tour here. Like, there is no Borders. Like, when was
right.
the last time?
See, it's gone. Been? It's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. You know, you're going to show up to nobody now. So what you do is, like, a viral campaign. It's all digital. It's all online. I'm talking to you, like, it's this crazy new medium, and it's so exciting to be on the cutting edge of it.
I've been speaking with Jesse Eisenstadt. His book is Surfing the Middle East, available now for the iPad, and the story on it's coming up this Thursday in the Indy. Jesse, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Hey, thank you.
This is Poodle Radio, by the way, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB 91.9. The track right now is Who Is It? It's Hosannas with When We Were Young, and I will give you the concert info at Muddy Waters. What day? I'll tell you just on the other side when we come back, talking to the Junior League of Santa Barbara, talking about promoting youth literacy, talking about making chocolates later. Stay tuned to Poodle Radio on KCSB 91.9 FM. I'm Colin Marshall. Keep it here.
the sky turned quite the green, that this one was never seen, the sky so full of water like this was falling from the sky above me, falling from the sky above me. I've never seen so many spiders crawling over me, never seen so many spider legs in the tree.
KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Colin Marshall. This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB, of course, 91.9. I don't have to remind you, you know. Thanks again to Jesse Eisenstadt for showing up for the little talk we had about surfing the Middle East. Now, as promised, we're going to have a conversation about something entirely different, but something still quite interesting, the promotion of youth literacy in Santa Barbara. And I have with me as well, you might want to put your headphones on there, Stacy. Headphones? There we go. Or Stacy. Why do I am not good with names. Her name is, of course, Christy Horton. She's the president of the Junior League of Santa Barbara. Christy, welcome to Poodle Radio.
Thank you very much for allowing us to speak with your audience.
Oh, yes. And I think they want to hear about this because people listening to KCSB are interested in public service. And the Junior League is all about public service. Tell us about the mission of the Junior League of Santa Barbara.
Absolutely. We have several parts to our mission. The first is obviously to improve the community, and we do that in a number of ways and a number of projects, and we can talk about that in a minute. The other aspect of our mission is to train women to be volunteer leaders and leaders in the community.
Now, how did this begin? Where do we have to go to find the roots of this whole project that the Junior League has?
Well, that's a great question. We're actually celebrating here in Santa Barbara our 85th anniversary this year.
85th?
Yes. However, the Junior League movement has been going on quite a bit longer than that. The Junior League was actually founded in New York 125 years ago, and it was founded in order to meet a critical unmet need at the time, which was to improve the conditions of the tenement settlements on the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
Oh, okay. And how did this? How wide is the scope of the sort of public service the Junior League does now? I mean, we're going to be talking about youth literacy, but
yes.
How part of it is? How big a part of it is that?
Well, we have over 500 members here in Santa Barbara and over 170,000 worldwide, and each Junior League, each local Junior League chooses something within the community that they view to be a very critical and unmet need. So here in Santa Barbara County, we noticed that over 20% of the children read below grade level in the elementary schools, and in some schools, over 50% read below grade level. So that was the big issue that we kind of grabbed onto and hope to address.
Now tell me how bad the effects are of this kind of a problem, of kids reading below grade level. I mean, what are the repercussions of a problem like this if it goes unhelped?
Well, that's a great question as well. I think what we really took away from it is that when children can't read, they can't realize their potential. They can't realize their dreams. I mean, that's kind of the broadest scope of it. But I hate to say it in this sad way, but when you look at prison construction, for example, in the state of California, one of the major statistics they look at is third grade reading levels, and they use that to project prison construction.
Mm. That is a surprising fact. Now they take this number. And they say they go by the amount of people who can't read up to that level at
that's
that
right.
point, and they say, we're going to build this many cells?
That's right.
Yikes.
That's right.
So it's that accurate a measure of kids who might not who might lose their way later
right.
in life?
Right, exactly. And so what we look to do is really to kind of tackle that issue early on and to instill a love of reading in children at an early age, and to also bring in the families so that they support the children visiting the libraries and reading outside of the school and the home.
By the way, if you've just tuned in, this is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB 91.9 FM. I'm Colin Marshall, talking to Christy Horton, president of the Junior League of Santa Barbara. And tell us, what kind of concrete activities go on to promote youth literacy that the Junior League does?
Well, this year we actually have 12 projects that we're working on, so we are quite busy. About half of those projects are with the public library system, and the other half are with the public schools. Hmm. In the public library, probably the best-known project that we're working on right now is taking the basement of the library and creating an 8,000-square-foot children/youth space. And so this is a very large project for us, a signature project. And then surrounding that, of course, are the programming projects such as the Dia de los Niños, Dia de los Libros, award-winning project, which is basically an arts and crafts reading fair that we do every year at the library. We also have various book clubs. We have a teen book club coming up in April, and some of those are in English, some are in Spanish, and some are bilingual. Then in the public schools, we have things that really get the kids excited, like the Heroes for a Day at La Patera School, where we have local firefighters and police and other kind of, recognizable figures come and read a book to the kids. And it is just a blast.
The kind of figures kids will know on site and think, hey, pretty cool.
Wow. Yeah.
So I want to get a little bit of an idea from, you know, just your own experience of how this overall project of helping youth literacy is going. I mean, maybe not even in terms of numbers, but just in terms of your experience of sort of what's been really interesting about what the Junior League has been doing to you. I mean, that you've seen, that you've participated in. What's been fascinating for you to watch about all this and to do?
Well, I could talk quite a bit about this. I've been in the Junior League for 15 years, in three different Junior Leagues, actually, in New York, in Boston, and Santa Barbara. And I think with the youth literacy focus, what really strikes me every time is when we open the doors for a project like a reading party, and the kids literally burst in the door. I mean, they, yeah.
A lot of kids.
And they come running toward the bookshelves. They can't wait to hear the stories, and it's just the energy. A lot of these kids, we are having sign up for their library card for the first time. So it's like pent up energy. And I can't wait to see where these kids go.
It's true, you know, see where they go in life, but it's got to be interesting to see just sort of what they gravitate to when they do get the sort of reading opportunities, is it not?
It is. It's fascinating. They, of course, one funny thing is when you finish reading a story, they are very often say, again. But yes, we've actually been able to partner with some of the local authors here in Santa Barbara County. And so it seems like there's always something new that we can present to the kids and kind of get them, pull them in and show how reading is fun.
Now, there's something we should sort of get the information out there about toward the end of the segment, which is the Youth Literacy Gala that's going on. And this is going to happen, I have, according to my detailed notes here, Saturday, March 5th at the Coral Casino in Montecito. What is this event?
So this is one of our two fundraisers for the year to fund all 12 of our projects. So this is a big deal for us. Of course, it's going to be a lot of fun. We have a literacy theme, which is Alice in Wonderland. It's called Falling into Wonderland. And the purpose of this is kind of twofold. One is to get the word out regarding our mission, as we're doing today, but also to raise money to benefit the target children in improving youth literacy.
Now, beyond this, beyond the specific events going on in the present, I mean, what do you want to see in the future of the Youth Literacy Project that the Santa Barbara Junior League is doing? I mean, what are your, you know, the sort of wildest dream ideas for what you'd like to see it accomplish in the next few years?
Well, that's a great question, and it's always something that we wrestle with, because even at the state level, building metrics to measure literacy improvement is very difficult.
Right.
But we view it as, you know, this is something that has to be tackled, an issue that has to be tackled one-on-one, parent to child, reader to, you know, reader to child. And one thing that I'd love to see would be a project that we have in development, which is a Reading Buddies program, so that each child who goes into the public library has an adult reader to sit and read with them. And I think that by doing that, by one, improving the attendance statistics, which are already very, very good, but improving the number of children who come to the library, know where it is, ask to go there, but also the number of children who actually have a reading experience there at the library would be a great dream for us.
Now, people can go to jlsantabarbara.org to find out more about the Junior League, but if they really want to know more or want to help out, you know, what do you suggest they do?
That's a great question. I would suggest that that they call the office or contact us through the website, and we have several programs where we can bring in people from the community to help. One, of course, is the Heroes for a Day project, which I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
If you're, if you're a policeman, fireman, something like that, if you need a uniform, we would love to have you participate. But also, we can pair you up with the library to work with them in some of the projects that they have going on that we are involved with, such as the reading parties that I mentioned. We most certainly can use some additional help.
I've been speaking with Christy Horton, the president of the Junior League of Santa Barbara, about their youth literacy projects, the Youth Literacy Gala, coming up on March 5th and more. And I know you're busy, Christy. Thanks so much for taking the time to come on the show this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. Right now, we're hearing A Big Tree with the Concurrence of All Things. Concert info about that and the Hosannas track earlier, just on the other side, when we'll talk about chocolate. Stay tuned. It's Poodle Radio, KCSB 91.9 FM.
Never seen so many spiders crawling over me. Never seen so many spider legs in the tree. Falling from the sky above me. Falling from the sky above me. Kitchen sink, never seen so many tiny bubbles there.
face so beautiful as yours is. Never seen a smile so genuine and like yours is. Falling from the sky above me, falling from the sky above me.
KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Colin Marshall, and you have tuned in to Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. Thanks to Christy Horton, president of the Junior League of Santa Barbara, for showing up for that last segment. And we heard a cut after it from Big Tree. That's the Concurrence of all things. They're playing Muddy Waters on Saturday, March 5th, there in downtown Santa Barbara. And before that, we heard the Hosannas, I promised you some concert info. That was When We Were Young, and they're playing Muddy Waters Cafe, of course, I can't forget it's a cafe, on Monday, March 7th. Now, dear listeners, I have promised you chocolate. So, chocolate we will talk about. And joining me across the glass in Studio A here at KCSB is Mike Orlando of 24 Blackbirds Chocolates. Mike, welcome to the program.
Good morning, thank you.
Now, Matt Kettman has a story coming up in the Indie about you guys and what you do with chocolate. And this is, I think, how could it not interest people? But what the angle I found interesting was in the story, or as I was talking to Matt about it, you got into coffee roasting, and that was kind of your entree into getting into chocolate roasting. I mean, is that how it worked?
Yeah, pretty much.
Really?
Home coffee roasting required me to build a coffee roaster.
Yeah.
And so in trying to build a coffee roaster, researching coffee roasting, I came across a chocolate roasting site. And that kind of reignited a spark of making chocolate that I had had when I was in high school. And so, you know, about 15 years later, it was all right at my fingertips. And so...
So you get the people have roasted coffee. I mean, not a lot of people, but people more people that have roasted coffee at home than they have roasted chocolate. You know, what are the... How well do those skills transfer? I mean, what sort of physical, I imagine there's some physical ability that's shared by the two. But I mean, how does that help you to know about roasting coffee when you then move into chocolate?
It's a huge help when it comes to making a roast. How can I put this? Making the roast give you the desired results at the end in chocolate. In coffee, the coffee beans are very sensitive to temperature and time and ramp and all of that. Chocolate's very forgiving, and so it's much easier than coffee roasting to roast cocoa beans.
And so you do this, and I mean, what kind of results do you get, or how long does it take you to get results to where you think this is viable. I could sell this to the refined palates of Santa Barbara, shall we call them?
It actually depends on the bean that you're using. Some beans are very forgiving, where they're not, the end product is not a very complex flavor. There's not a lot of fruits. There's kind of just a straight ahead roasted cocoa flavor. And that's relatively easy to get. I mean, it's not just put it in the oven at any temperature and pull it out. But after, you know, a series of kind of roasting trials, you can get that pretty easily. The bars we're doing now, the Rio Caribe, is very complicated. It's very sensitive to temperature. It's sensitive to all the steps after refining and conching and all the flavor modification steps that come after roasting.
Now, there's a lot to master in this process, but for you personally, I mean, was it always in your head something that was going to be a business, or was there a point where you said, I think I can make this for a buying public?
Initially, it was not in my mind to start a business, but after you make a few batches of real chocolate, you know, in your kitchen at home, you think, God, why am I not just making a bunch of this? You know, everybody loves it, you know, and it's fun to do. And so it didn't take long for the business idea to come in.
So tell us about the scale you're working at 24 Blackbirds. I mean, in the article, Matt will talk about how this is, you're working at a smaller scale than most chocolate producers, but What's the scope of the operation? I mean, give us an idea of what it offers you, you know, advantage wise, or how big you'd like to grow, or you know, where is it right now?
We're extremely small. We do everything by hand. We can pretty much process about 30 pounds of cocoa beans a week, which sounds like a lot when you think about eating that much chocolate. But when you think about a chocolate business, most are, you know, an order of magnitude bigger than us. And that's the smallest micro batch chocolate makers.
Right. And that's going to set you apart right there, is that small scale. But what else do you have to do to say, look, I know you've had a lot of chocolate. This is the chocolate you want to try. I mean, what do you do?
It comes down to attention to detail. Hmm. We hand sort essentially every single bean. We sort through every bean to make sure that it's a good bean. You know, essentially, there's a lot of specific faults a bean can have, but we sort through by hand. So we're weeding out right there a lot of off flavors that a bigger producer can't afford to do. They're, you know, working on, you know, 1,000 pounds of beans at a time. They don't have time to pick through by hand.
They don't have one bean that's the reject to throw away, you know. They let those in.
They have a big machine, and the machine doesn't know the difference between, say, a cracked open bean and a good bean.
Right.
As long as it's the right size. And so
how much of a skill is this a distinction that somebody who's a serious chocolate enthusiast will really recognize, or is it something anybody can easily taste, you know, when you have this hand sorting, when you have the micro processes that you're able to use at this 24 Blackbird scale?
It's really noticeable if you put two bars side by side. Again, it's like any like really fine food. You have to be at least thinking about it. You know, of course, you can take a big bite, swallow it down, and it'll be gone before you taste anything. If you're paying attention and you're tasting two chocolates side by side, you will definitely see a difference.
What do you recommend? I mean, people eat chocolate by itself a lot, but do you see it as a food you can combine with other foods, or is this, do you make chocolate to be consumed purely by itself as chocolate?
All of the above.
Versatile. Okay.
I think chocolate is incredibly versatile in that it can be like a sweet and a savory component of a dish. Like a mole is kind of very savory.
No, I love mole.
Whereas like in desserts, chocolate's always really sweet. And so right now we're making chocolates to eat, but the chocolate we have at home, the stuff, like kind of the reject stuff we cook with, we experiment with, and it works out great in all kinds of applications.
I mean, what perspective does it give you being in such close proximity to chocolate so often for so long, getting these individual beans sorted, thinking of ways to set your chocolate apart, 24 Blackbird's chocolate apart? I mean, what kind of perspective does this give you on this thing that people think of as, you know, a treat, a nice thing to have, but that they don't think too deeply about usually? I mean, what have you learned that is kind of that people just wouldn't get if they weren't actually making the stuff?
I think most people don't know where it comes from.
Oh, really?
They don't realize that cocoa beans are a tropical commodity, essentially.
Oh.
And so part of what we want to do, kind of as we grow a little bigger, is have kind of educational events where we talk about where chocolate comes from, because it's all from third world countries, minus there's a plantation in Hawaii. But for the most part, the farmers are faced with all kinds of adverse conditions that in the U.S. it's a luxury product. For them, it's like growing wheat or, you know, anything like that.
It's unremarkable.
Just their way of life. So I've learned kind of the dark side of the chocolate industry.
Now, we've been enticing listeners for a while about these chocolates. Where do they go if they want to learn more, if they want to try some, or if they just have an interest they need to satiate about 24 Blackbirds?
You can find our bars at the French Press downtown. Chocolate Maya, also downtown, carries them. Municipal Winemakers Tasting Room, and Loop and Leaf.
And as well, of course, Matt Kettman has a story on 24 Blackbirds coming up in, I believe, the next issue of The Independent coming out Thursday. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. I've been Colin Marshall, and this has been a packed show. So if you want to hear it again, you can visit independent.com. We archive them all there every Thursday. And of course, any feedback, questions, comments, whatever, send that along to Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at independent.com. That is Colin at independent.com. Thanks for tuning in. I'll catch you here next Tuesday, 8 a.m., for another Poodle Radio on KCSB.